This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Whistleblowers. Some people see them as heroes, and some people see them as a danger to society. The Whistleblowers Protection Act 2010 itself has always been debated.
What if the secrets were leaked with the interests of the public in mind? You know, for the greater good.
Isn't that a good thing? You would think so. Of course, for certain parties, that's the ultimate fear. Exposés are as welcome as a thorn in the side or root canal.
Julian Assange comes to mind, though his crimes far more severe, particularly exposing the US government's defense information on his infamous site WikiLeaks, as opposed to, for example, exposing a government-owned company's wrongdoings. Who can forget Mark Felt, better known as Deep Throat, who was revealed as the FBI's informant in the Watergate scandal that eventually led to the downfall of then-US President Richard Nixon.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Kaur.
This is In Case You Missed It. This week, we take a look at the proposed amendment to the Official Secrets Act 1972 to include heavy punishments for journalists who break the law.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling. Myanmar's struggle for peace with rebels continues, and Philippines' own Donald Trump appears in the presidential election.
Ethnic rebels have been at war with the Burmese military for over six decades. Any attempts to finalize a peace deal between the groups have always been underscored by deep mistrust. Since Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party's victory in the national elections last November, ethnic groups are hoping the new government will have a better chance at securing a peace deal. Pyu Zin Po has more from Kaya State.
Kupo, a mother of four, is looking after her children in this refugee camp on the Thai-Burmese border. She has been living in the camp for more than 20 years, but she remembers clearly when the government army entered her village of Loiko.
We collected our belongings and ran away from the village. I was so scared and cried. Soldiers has burned down houses in our village, and our family had to run to the top of a mountain.
Kupo's parents were involved with Karani Revolutionary Fighters and the Karani National Progressive Party. Founded in 1957, the group has been fighting against the Burmese military government for self-determination in their state. Like Karani, many other ethnic groups in the country claim they have been treated unfairly and are not given a fair share to the natural resources in their state. They also want self-autonomy on their land. When the army launched its offensive in her village, Kupo and her family were forced to keep running.
We had to run to one village after another. We ran from Nan Ong village to another village, and then we ran to the Thai border to hide from the Burmese soldiers.
After reaching Thailand, her family faced another struggle, finding enough food to survive. Kupo says they went to homes or Thai families and chopped wood for many to find food. Now Kupo is 40, and much of her life has been spent in this refugee camp. Her village was burned down to the ground and is now covered with landmines. She says she doesn't even recognize it anymore and is not safe to return. Conflict between ethnic groups and government forces has been going on for more than six decades. There are more than 51 different ethnic groups in Burma, including eight main ethnic groups and 135 ethnic subgroups. After General Ne Win took the power in 1962, many ethnic groups took up arms. The government of Thein Sein signed a ceasefire agreement with some rebel groups in October last year, but the largest groups refused to sign. Xue Myudan from the Karani National Progressive Party explains why.
The government needed to prove to us that their will was genuine. But that did not happen as we expected. On one hand, to sign the nationwide ceasefire agreement. While on the other hand, the government armies are still launching offensives for battles. It is really hard to believe their promise.
Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi led the NLD party to a historic win in Burma's election last November. During the campaign, Suu Kyi said solving ethnic conflicts was one of her priorities. Shin Myo then welcomes the NLD's plans, but he remains skeptical.
We know how long it has taken us to discuss the ethnic conflict issue. We have been building trust between key players of government peacemakers. But at that time, the NLD didn't get involved in the peace processes and they remain as an opposition party. Will the NLD understand us? We don't know what sympathy they have for us. We are worried about that.
Some political commentators say the NLD will face enormous challenges when dealing with the Burmese military. But Jo Tin-ang, an activist from Union of Karani State Youth Association, argues the NLD is held in high regard by different ethnic groups.
Since 1988, the NLD proclaimed reconciliation and they are leading talks with both sides, the military and armed ethnic groups. We believe they understand the need from both sides and they can achieve a permanent peace deal through political dialogue.
But can the NLD really achieve this goal? To find out, I have been calling them all week, but each time has been told to call back.
Now, I'm in front of the NLD office to meet one of the NLD top leaders who can tell me their plan for nationwide ceasefire agreement.
But again, the NLD has refused to give any concrete answers. The fighting between ethnic groups and government troops escalated right after the November election. Still, Kupo is hopeful a solution will soon be achieved.
I hope the new government can deal with other armed groups and stop the civil wars. If the government can do so, we can go back our home. We will have our civil right in our country. I don't want to be a refugee anymore.
No one is really sure just how successful the NLD will be. But the way it looks right now, it certainly won't be easy. For Asia Calling, this is Pyu Zimpo in Luai Kor, the state capital of Kenya.
Restoring balance can never be an easy task, especially with roots so deeply wounded like what's happening in Myanmar right now. But we can't blame all of them for choosing to be divided, because after all, they were under brutal military rule up until now when Aung San Suu Kyi's party has taken over after crazy historic elections. And news is that she plans to unite all these ethnicities back again under one Burma. Good luck to her, Cheryl. The world will be watching.
Aung San Suu Kyi has big shoes to fill and a lot to live up to. The thing is, will she be able to bridge the divide and the mistrust which has been rooted in years and years of conflict? We're talking about a situation which is multifaceted, involving socioeconomic issues, differences in ethnic nationalities, with overlapping sets of conflicts. It's going to take a lot of time to get them all together to resolve the issue. The Philippines will vote for a new president in May. And from the list of presidential candidates, a tough-talking mayor is climbing to the top of the polls. Known as the Dirty Harry for stopping crimes in the city, Rodrigo Duterte has also been likened to Donald Trump. From Manila and Palawan, Jofel Tosorio and Ariel Carlos find out more.
Alam mo, ang binigay kong standard sa police, pati military ganito.
When Rodrigo Duterte addresses a rally called Mad for Change, the crowd goes wild and chants his name. The tough-talking mayor of Davao City formally announced his bid for presidency only late November. He has vowed to stop criminality and eradicate corruption.
I can promise you not heaven, but I will promise you a comfortable life. Corruption has to stop. Criminality has to stop.
Duterte's entry to the presidential race is a real game-changer. Popular figures such as Senator Grace Poe, Vice President Jeju Marbinay, and former Interior Secretary Mar Rojas have dominated the polls. But many voters see Duterte's brand of politics as refreshing, different from the other candidates drawn from the political elites. While its numbers slipped last month, a survey by Pulse Asia Research this November showed Duterte with 34% of the popular vote, 8% higher than his closest rival. Political observer Jose Fernandez explains.
And being an attorney,
being an attorney and being fiscal at that, and with all the stories about how he deals with criminals, instead of eroding his charisma, it has enhanced it even more. And Filipinos think maybe we need this kind of president.
Duterte has been mayor of Davao, a city of 2 million people, for 22 years. He has also served as vice mayor and congressman. He is credited for making it the safest city in the country, but through controversial means. Human rights groups accuse him of supporting a group of vigilantes that extrajudicially kill criminals and drug pushers. There have been around 1,000 suspected criminals who were allegedly executed without trial during his term in Davao City. One of Duterte's close friends, Butch Chase, says these accusations are hearsay.
These human rights issues are all hearsay. As a friend, he never told me that he ordered the killings of a criminal or of someone. There are only small things like he would say, if this criminal won't listen to me, I'll warn him, and if not, he should fear of his life.
Many see Duterte's popularity as a product of a breakdown of law and order and endemic corruption. The mayor has a moniker, Duterte Hari, for his style of swift justice. Duterte in a rally says he simply hates criminals.
Pag nakita kayo ng militar pati police,
if the military or the police see you, you are a criminal, a carnapper, a kidnapper, and you are on bail because the evidences against you are not strong enough. I will also abduct you. I will do whatever you did to your victim.
He is also called the Donald Trump of the Philippines because he admits to being a womanizer and has a penchant for using expletives even in public. Still, Duterte's image resonates. The common Filipino voter is desperate for someone who will represent them, says civil society activist and environmentalist Jerty Anda.
I'd like to echo what the taxi driver told me. A taxi driver said, I would rather vote for a guy whose mouth is dirty because he speaks dirty, but he has no corruption charges whatsoever, rather than voting for a candidate who goes to church, who speaks clean language, but who is linked with corruption and who is so corrupt. So he represents, in a sense, yeah, the general public.
Unlike other candidates, Duterte also has an image of being incorruptible. Activist Jerty Anda says the common Filipino aspires security and a corruption-free society. This is what the Duterte brand offers.
To them, the crimes of womanizing, bad-mouthing, you know, killings, that can be forgotten as long as basic services are actually implemented. So you see, the priorities now are basic services. As long as there would be no corruption, poverty can be addressed. To them, that is enough.
Jaren Atrero, a young professional, will vote for Duterte. He believes the mayor can deliver on his promises.
He's a concrete example of a true change. He is a man of his words. You know, Filipinos are craving for change. He's not a traditional politician. He's very different. If you can see his platforms, very simple, and that's very smart, attainable. I believe he's the one.
Filipinos today feel insecure because of crimes, especially in the cities. Duterte offers a clear platform of dealing with criminality, a feature his competitors lack. But not everyone, including voter Ken Chan, is impressed.
Ayoko siya maging presidente ng Pilipinas.
I don't want him to become president because he has a lot of characteristics that don't fit a true leader. I don't like his leadership style that uses force.
Activist Jerty Anda also sees some red flags. She says Filipinos should not immediately believe the hype.
That is his strength, but there are still blind areas, you know. What is good governance for him? How will he address social justice issues of agrarian reform? The land issue is still dominant in this country, you know. Natural resource use, you know, how do you deal with corruption?
But the way the numbers look right now, it's not impossible that Rodrigo Duterte could be the next president of the Philippines. With Ariel Carlos from Palawan and Manila, Philippines, this is Joe Feltisorio for Asia Calling.
Whoa. This new Donald Trump brand of politics is contagious. First, he makes us all hate him, like loathe and despise him. Now he's leading in the U.S. primaries. He won so far about three, I think, right? Which is mind-boggling. Gone are traditional politicians. Political correctness is out the window. Just throw it out. The trendy thing to do now are politicians who run their mouth loose, but being brutally honest about what they want and what they can do. Now the people have spoken, and they don't want the old brand of politics. It doesn't work anymore. Clean cut, but then corrupted, just don't fly. Rude, uncouth, harsh, temperamental, but honest is the new wave. But Cheryl, is this the right wave to ride?
I don't know, Aisha. See, the gravitation towards Donald Trump-like politicians who are brash and tell it like it is, it all stems from people who are tired of political spin talk. But will politicians like this do well when it comes to dealing with foreign countries? You can't just yell at another premier or ridicule him. There has to be some finesse that's required, some subtlety.
Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. After the break, we explore the proposed amendment to the Official Secrets Act 1972 and how journalists could be punished for carrying out their duty to inform the public of wrongdoings.
All that in a minute.
I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Kaur.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is, in case you missed it. I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Kaur.
2015 was a very trying year for journalists and journalism in Malaysia. The Edge was suspended for 3 months over their 1MDB reporting. News organizations were forced to shut down. The Sarawak Report was blocked. And just a few days ago, the Malaysian Insider was blocked for national security reasons.
Journalists are reeling from this clampdown and we are angry. Now add to that the fact that the Attorney General recently proposed for an amendment to the Official Secrets Act 1972 with extended punishments for journalists and whistleblowers. This blatantly adds to the climate of fear they are trying to cultivate.
In a recent interview with BFM's Pressing Matters, Eric Paulson from Lawyers for Liberty and Akmal Nasi from whistleblower organisation National Oversight and Whistleblowers Centre explained the scope of the OSA and how it affects whistleblowing. Let's start with Eric explaining what exactly is considered official secrets under the Official Secrets Act 1972.
Well, the Official Secrets Act has been around, it's basically based on the older National Official Secrets Act, that's 1911. So it's an archaic piece of legislation, basically set up during the time where the government knows best. We are talking about wars and espionage and spying. But now, as you are looking forward to 2015, 2016, I think it's certainly questionable whether the language and the types of secret that is being protected under the Official Secrets Act should be as wide as it is right now.
There is this perception that the OSA protects really big official government secrets. For example, defense contracts. But increasingly, it seems not so official things like haze falls into the category too. Which brings the question, what exactly falls under national security?
If you look under the Official Secrets Act, the actual statute itself, there's a schedule that says that any cabinet document, records, decision, deliberation, including those of cabinet committees, and also issues regarding national security, defense, and international relations, you know, there are blanket protection under the Official Secrets Act. So if you were to release any of such documents, or if you were to receive, technically you could be charged and jailed, minimum 1 year, up to 7 years. They don't actually look at the actual content. So if, for example, a cabinet committee were to discuss the budget of the breakfast meeting or the Prime Minister's breakfast cabinet meeting, for example, if that was released, technically, you could be charged for the OSA. So even though it does not really relate to national security or national defence.
Here's Akmal explaining how his work with NOW falls under the OSA.
Most of the documents that we receive, especially from the government departments, in a way, they are related to this OSA provision. But to say that the documents, all the documents are under OSA is not necessarily right, because most of the information we receive, not necessarily from the inside, but we may receive from the tail end. So basically, the trail of the paperwork we may get actually outside the government department before we can start digging further, and later on we may stumble into the cabinet papers and etc.
In our conversation at the end of the Pressing Matters segment, Akmal noted he believes the proposed amendment will in fact go through, but Eric is cautiously optimistic and feels public pressure will be enough to stop the OSA amendments from being passed.
It's pretty clear that the OSA has been misused for arbitrary reasons and for a very long time at that. But up until now, journalists weren't subjected to the heavy penalties, especially not close to the kind suggested by the Attorney General.
I spoke to Gayatri Venkateswaran, the former executive director of the Southeast Asian Press Alliance, to get her thoughts on the proposed amendments. So Gayatri, the OSA, it's not a new act and it's been around for quite a while. How have journalists been affected by the original 1972 Act and the amendment in 1986?
Since the law was enacted, it has been used a lot against opposition politicians. But in the 1980s, actually during the time of Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, there were a number of cases or reports that actually relied on what we would consider as, say, secret information or restricted information. But it actually had to do with the Malaysian economy. It had to do with the Malaysian relations with China. And also regarding procurement of something related to defence. Actually, this was a report done by a former NSD journalist in 1984, 1985. So in the mid-1980s, there was actually a series of cases where the OSA was used against the journalists. So the first local journalist to have been charged and fined under this law was that NSD journalist, Sabri Sharif. And after that, the Prime Minister actually went to Parliament and made the amendments to the law, which then included mandatory jail sentence. And then there was a lot of protest by journalist groups and other CSOs. And then after that, I think there was a little bit more of a silence. And then again, 2000s onwards, in terms of CSOs, again, opposition politicians, and then journalists. So there was a bit of a quiet time, but in the recent years, we've seen that, you know, because too many cases that really needed the kind of investigation and reporting. So that's kind of a very general map of how it was used against journalists.
As you've already said, there was the provision of a jail sentence. So now, with the new proposal that the Attorney General has suggested, he says that they want to increase the punishment under the amendment, and they want to include life imprisonment and 10 strokes of the cane. And this specifically targets journalists.
I mean, we can easily say that this kind of fear that they're trying to put into what is legitimate exposes and legitimate investigations. Now, the OSA itself is problematic because there is no oversight whatsoever about the kinds of classifications of documents. Who actually look through all of this and say, oh, you know, this should not be classified or this should actually be made public? It is really something that is done with no scrutiny at all. So the way documents are classified is completely arbitrary. It is probably a blanket imposition of the kinds of restrictions. It doesn't matter whether it's restricted or secret. The point is that the civil service, together with the political ruling party, has basically said any information should not be released. So, I mean, the problem already comes from the law that has this blanket coverage of secrecy. And so there is already the first level of problem. So now, despite the fact that the law already has a mandatory jail sentence, and the burden is really on the person who has been accused to impose this further punishment, or as proposed, I think it's very clear that it's saying keep away from public information, because I think it's a fear of how much information will get out and affect the credibility of the government.
I see. What if a whistleblower comes to us with information? We are bound by our code of ethics as journalists, you know, to report things that are accurate, fair, and in public interest. We can't just ignore it because of fear. But journalists are rattled. How do you foresee the act impeding on journalists and their work?
Well, I think that actually over the years, the different laws have had its impact already on the media in terms of already self-censorship or actually being penalized through various means. So you've had very few journalists who, you know, brave the weather and actually go ahead with what information they have received. So the impact has already been there. You can count pretty much the kind of investigative stories that have been there from the initiative of journalists or whistleblowers. So that's one. The impact has already been there. Secondly, unfortunately, whistleblowers who go to the media first actually do not get the kind of protection that they should get. So that's already made clear. that already imposes a second layer of risk to the whistleblower. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the media should be able to make a judgment of whether this is a public interest issue and give it the space or the coverage that it deserves, and bound by ethical practices, definitely. So I think that the controls have been there. It is now being strengthened. It will not only cause fear among the media, or fear in the sense that you will think maybe 3-4 times, you know, whether you want to risk your license, but also for the people who actually want to expose the kinds of wrongdoing. So it's really a message to everyone that don't even think about trying to expose. And secondly, don't even think about trying to write about it. The impact now with this proposal will be both to the sources as well as to the media.
Exactly. And it's as if they're trying to say whistleblowing, it's a big no-no. Don't do it, because if you do, you're going to get into big trouble.
Exactly.
You've been a journalist for 8 years now. Have you been in a situation where you've had documents given to you, confidential documents perhaps?
No, I have not, but my colleagues have. So I definitely know that a few of my brave colleagues who had information be given to them, they have had to struggle through the kinds of legal repercussions, but also in terms of looking at the story itself, the importance of the story. So yes, in our newsroom, we definitely had editors and journalists who have information be given to them. And they are really very important stories, and some stories have been published. It's a risk that the journalists take every time that they are confronted with this.
And how exactly did your colleagues go about reporting those?
Well, you know, I mean, I think all journalists are sort of trained to try and triangulate the information to make sure that this is not just one person trying to, maybe with a very personal agenda. So you try to also track through other paper trail. It takes time. So it's not something that you just get information today and tomorrow the story is written. So you have to do a lot of verification as well. And as far as possible to get other paper trails, which is the biggest challenge.
Exactly.
So you have to sort of like compare with other information, try to look for maybe public documents that will be able to tell part of the story, and also try to convince the sources and other contacts that their identities will not be revealed if they request it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes time, and that's why investigative reporting is a very high resource initiative, you know. So you spend a lot of time trying to get information either from people or from documents. So it is a rigorous process, and also you need the backing of your editors to make sure that you get that support as well, you know. So that all in combination is something that builds the investigative stories.
Gayatri, why do you think whistleblowing is seen so negatively by the authorities and some other quarters?
Very clearly, it's because it exposes wrongdoing on their part. Often, we're talking about either government-held or business-held information that would expose some of their wrongdoing. So, you know, if you have someone actually whistleblowing on your, you know, whether you've taken some money or you've wrongly awarded contracts, things like that, it puts that person or that group of people basically under scrutiny. So it could cost them their jobs, bad reputation. We're talking about really protecting, what they call that, your position, despite being all the wrongdoings. And that's why you look at whistleblowers in a very negative light. In the context that we are in, where there are very, very high-level financial irregularities, we would assume that there is a group of people at different levels who have been involved in allowing or approving those kind of decisions. So if someone actually exposes that, there's a lot of people who could lose their jobs. It's really frowned upon, you know, because then you're challenging the status quo at the end of the day.
Given your experience and all, how can whistleblowing be done ethically and appropriately?
Well, I mean, I think whistleblowing is something that happens particularly in systems or in situations where the cost of being open is very, very high. So in other words, when you have a transparent system, when you have governance that's based on openness, actually the need for whistleblowing is probably lower, with the assumption that if you have an open government, you can, as citizens, you know, track and monitor and actually see whether decisions are being made in a fair manner. But when you have systems that are closed, that restrict information and the flow of information, then there are few options, especially if media also cannot do their jobs to monitor, then whistleblowing is actually very, very crucial to be able to actually check on governance. But interestingly, you know, whistleblowing is much more protected in systems that are open. So you know that it's a kind of a culture and a mindset that we need open and transparent governance. And so we encourage whistleblowing. Mm-hmm. Because we are here to provide for the public. But in systems like ours, very clearly, it's a closed system. in terms of information and accountability. And that's why there is a need for whistleblowing. We rely on people who feel that this information has to go out and hope that they feel brave enough to give out that information.
Yeah, exactly. And especially of late, we can hear the clamoring for a more transparent system and not something that's so opaque where we don't really know what's going on in the upper echelons of Putrajaya.
Yes, absolutely. I think that if the ministers who have wrongly pointed out that people don't do whistleblowing in other places, if they want a society that they don't have to confront with whistleblowers, I think that's a very simple solution. Be open, be transparent, and be accountable. Because that is what it's all about. It is about people in power, whether it's business, corporate, or political power, to exercise accountability and to be fair. Because if you're open and transparent, then people will be able to judge and weigh what are the issues. In this current situation, where all the critical information has been blocked, then more people feel angry towards the entire government, which may be unfair because not everyone is involved in the kinds of wrongdoing. Actually, to direct the criticism towards the right groups of people, actually, it's better for it to be transparent. Then you know who are the exact people responsible for it. But now, I think that the burden is actually on the entire government machinery because there is absolutely no access to that kind of information. So the criticism is towards everyone rather than specific groups, you know. To be more efficient, to be more targeted at the criticism, actually it's much better to be open and transparent.
How will the amendment to the Official Secrets Act affect the Whistleblowing Act then?
Well, we haven't seen and we don't expect to see any draft until the day it's actually put on the tables of the members of parliament, unfortunately. So we don't know really how it's going to look like, if at all this is something they're serious about. I'm not sure entirely how it will affect whistleblowing, but I think here it's very targeted because the OSA itself is already extremely unjust and punitive. It's very broad as well in terms of who it covers. So I think when the Whistleblowers Act was actually tabled, there was already criticism in terms of the coverage of the Act. So I think it actually is not in tandem already. And I think that their focus is really not on protection anymore. It's really going towards curtailing information and the disclosure of information. I think we already have many laws in this country that are in contradiction with each other. And we have seen that the ones that tend to control really trump over the ones that are meant to protect. I think that they are not bothered about the protection. They are really focused on putting in more measures to
control and clamp down.
Yes, yeah. Correct. Are we actually in this year of 2016 and the 21st century putting in measures in the laws that are so outdated? Are we actually heading towards really very 13th, 14th century style of controlling? So instead of being more progressive, it's really regressive. You know, you're talking about the kinds of punishment that, as you said much earlier, you know, it is for hardcore criminals, maybe, you know. It's not at all proportionate to the kinds of issues that are related to access to information. It's not proportionate at all.
Exactly. And the Attorney General, when he had proposed these amendments to the OSA, he had likened the punishment, which was the 10 strokes of the cane and life imprisonment, he likened this to China, saying that, oh, China has worse laws. So you're using a country like China where information is so secretive and everything is undercover, lock and key. How can you, I just don't understand how we can use that as our benchmark.
Absolutely. I mean, are we then aiming for a communist system, apparently? I think it's very worrying that, as you say, you know, what are we using as benchmarks? The benchmarks that we're using are of worse-off countries. And our government is looking at countries that have much poorer human rights record to say that we want to emulate that kind of practices. It's not a surprise because it's not the first time that they've looked at China. They've looked at Singapore has similar regime for its model for the laws. I mean, even some years ago when they talked about the Great Firewall, also they looked at China as the model. So it's very worrying that you would look towards countries with poorer records as your model instead of looking at countries which with far better records. This is really regressing in terms of the justice system, in terms of constitutional practices. So we're really looking at clamping down as much as we can using any kinds of tools. So, you know, China is not the model to go for. So it's hypocrisy also at the foreign policy level and domestic level, where on the one hand you have this anti-China rhetoric, and then on the other hand you are taking on the system, you're taking on the investments from China. So it's also, people need to be very aware of this kind of hypocrisy that is played out.
What other countries have had Official Secrets Act laws or something similar, and how has that worked out for those countries?
Well, interestingly, the former British colonies, many of them have secrecy laws. We retain it, Singapore has retained it, Burma has retained it, Myanmar has retained it. And then you also have other forms of laws that work the same way, because if you look at the origins of the Official Secrets Act, its context is this treason, giving information to foreign governments or bodies. So there's that element of treason lurking in the law. Because of that, then you see other countries having other forms of laws that are intended to also tackle this issue. So you have intelligence law, like in Indonesia, but that was only passed like a few years ago. So the Official Secrets Act is generally a legacy of some of the colonial powers. In other countries in Southeast Asia, like Vietnam, Laos, you have, similar to China, one party rule, the Communist Party, and so they have all kinds of mechanisms to block information. So it's not necessarily just an Official Secrets Act. It is contained in many other legal provisions or sort of mechanisms. So it's quite widespread in that sense. So we have actually different kinds of laws that regulate secrecy, official secrecy. But at the same time, then you have countries in this region that are also much more open, that try to, you know, make sure that citizens' access to information is still there, like Indonesia. Thailand, despite its coup and military rule, has had a freedom of information law. Philippines, the practices for access to information is much greater because other laws actually allow for citizens to get information. So it's mixed in that sense, but more and more laws that govern secrecy are actually being criticized and being regarded as in contradiction to human rights standards.
If this amendment is passed, how will it affect exposés like The Edges, 1MDB?
It makes it easier for the government to curb and to take action. We see some of the amendments in the last few years where the effect is that basically it makes it easier for enforcement agencies to take action. So I think that A, the proposed penalties are intended as a deterrent, and secondly, is to make it easier to take action, to sort of begin investigations and to sort of prosecute. So those are the two main ones I think that they're going for, which is really send the signal that the cost of doing exposés is going to be absolutely high. It's criminal. We are making it even more punitive, so you think twice before you do it. So you have the Printing Presses and Publications Law that will come in order to, say, suspend the publication or close down. But that would be in addition to, I think, what they may go for, which is to target individuals. So they may look at this to target the specific journalists, specific sources, and use the law against them. So you'd have two probably working at the same time. And because the punitive measures in the Printing Presses and Publications Law is not as high. So, you know, they're going to go for the ones that are more severe.
They're going to go all out, in other words?
All out, yes.
So Akmal Nasir from Now and Eric Paulson from LFL, we've asked them for their opinions on this. And Akmal Nasir thinks that the amendments will probably get passed. But Eric Paulson, he's more hopeful that public opinion will stop it from being passed. Do you think that this amendment will be passed?
You know, we can only be sure the moment it hits the table of the parliamentarians. If it's there, it's going to be passed. But until then, it's very difficult to speculate. I would agree with both of them in the sense that it is a way of testing, maybe, also the public opinion. I think that public opinion has had very little impact in lawmaking. So, you know, a lot of laws have been bulldozed through despite the kind of reactions that we've had over the years. But once it hits the table, there is no turning back and it will be in there. If it is possible to prevent that from happening, it would be good. But history has shown that it's very difficult to stop the kinds of amendments that have gone through. I mean, we've seen so many. I mean, the fact that we've had the National Security Bill, the fact that a few years ago we had the amendment to the Evidence Act. So all of these are indicative of how public opinion is not able to influence lawmaking.
The
That was Gayathri Venkateswaran, the former executive director of the Southeast Asian Press Alliance.
Parliament reconvenes on March 7th, and we'll be keeping a close eye to see if this proposed amendment to the Official Secrets Act is tabled.
This morning's show was produced by Cheryl Kaur, Hanif Baharuddin, Azif Azuddin, and me, Aisha Tajuddin.
I hope it's been food for thought, and remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is In Case You Missed It. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.